as you build a strategy around diversity and inclusion in your organization, I think you have to also build the expectation that we are working with and for each other.
Well, I'm super excited today to welcome Rosan Rivera Petrillo to Culture Matters. Rosan, or as she is really called, Rosa Maris is her name. Rosa Maris is a friend. She is a fellow Puerto Ricana, and she's the manager of equity, inclusion, and diversity at Kaiser Permanente in the Georgia region.
Yeah.
Welcome, Rosan. How are you? Good to talk with you.
I'm doing great. Thank you, Ricardo, for the opportunity. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Also, we're going to just have this interesting conversation about inclusion and diversity, right? I believe you guys have inclusion first and then diversity, and actually you have equity first. So I think a lot of people around the country who are, you know, they see corporations and they see these diversity and inclusion officers now, or they see the chief cultural officer, or they see all of these different things. I think there are a lot of questions that people have. So we'll get into that a little bit.
Let's talk about it and the different perspectives from, you know, at least our point of view and my personal point of view and what I hear out in the community, in their organizational community.
But before we get to that, let's learn a little bit about you, because you grew up in Puerto Rico, right? And then
yeah,
you moved to the United States. How old were you when you moved to the United States?
I was 25 years old. I just finished my master's when I decided to venture out and begin a life out of the little island and come into the mainland.
So what was that transition like for you culturally? Because even though Puerto Rico is an American colony or territory, still a big difference in the culture, right? And so what was that transition like?
Well, it was very interesting. Depending on the area I was in, I could feel some more warmth and more welcoming thoughts and embracing me as a person. And in some other aspects, it was a little bit more cold, you know? So you had to kind of begin to learn to navigate, begin to learn people individually to sort of break through that barrier and be able to connect with them individually. But I felt personally, it took time for me to be myself. I tend to be a very humorous, extroverted person and had difficulties being that, sort of acclimating not only to the environment, but to the language, and being able to speak how I used to in Spanish took a minute to do it in English.
Took a minute or took some years?
Yeah, I want to say probably a good 2 years before I could, you know, feel like I was saying a joke the way that I intended it to and had the reaction I wanted it to have, you know, because you have to begin to understand the people's mentalities and the, you know, idiosyncrasies of their culture and their upbringing.
It's kind of interesting, right? Because when we make a transition from one culture to another, it takes time. I think what's interesting about what you just said is not only does it take time to learn the culture that we're kind of moving into, it takes time to start feeling like we're ourselves again, right?
Yes. And I recognize that. I was looking for that moment throughout, you know, that early journey. I was really looking forward to being myself. I missed that about me. And I tried with a lot of effort and successfully, you know, in many aspects. But I knew that there were some barriers still that I had to advance and pass through. And so when I finally noticed it, I was happy. I could really feel the joy of being me.
So what's thrilling for me is that literally you're the first Puerto Rican that I've had on Culture Matters.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I should be, you know, I'm honored.
Previous guest, but you're the first Puerto Rican that I've had on the show. And
oh, that's
myself,
great to hear. I'm honored.
So I'm thrilled to have you. And I'm curious as to, because a lot of Puerto Ricans speak some English, right? But you spoke some English then, right? When you had had to do some study in English and so on and so forth. What was the difference between English that was spoken within the university setting or within your master's setting? And then when you actually got to the States and it was like real English. It wasn't like English in Puerto Rico. It was like real English. What was that transition for you?
Exactly. Potentially painful, but not as much as I expected it to be. I think as you are a student in university, you may find two different classes of professors that educate in English. So there's the ones that are actually U.S. American, you know, natives that are practicing their careers in Puerto Rico. And so they speak beautiful, perfect English. And then you have those professors that have learned English by traveling abroad and now having to educate in that language. So they're not, you know, as proficient, but they can educate you and, you know, hold a class in that language. Have sort of this mix of this Spanglish coming to you, what you learn from you were in preschool through your, you know, academic life. And then now you're, you know, bombarded by the books that have all this jargon and lexicon that's very, very deep and difficult. And then you have these professors are trying to say the words and they can't get them right themselves. And so it's a little bit painful, because when you then transition to the United States, you may find yourself, you know, with this mix of language, how they converge together in your brain. It's a little interesting. But you want to have, at least in my mind, I wanted to have the ability to speak with a lesser accent so that I could be understood. And that took practice. I began to just do some rehearsals while I was still in Puerto Rico. As I knew I was going to move out of the island, I just started to meet with more and more Americans that were students in the island. And so I would sit down with them and just practice and have long conversations about anything, you know, daily life, their own education, how was their experience living in the island, my own personal experiences, you know. And so I was able to begin to have those relationships with folks that were Americans, and so that I could have a better understanding of what that would eventually transition to be when I got here to the States. But it was not a simple feat. Yeah, it took time and effort and practice.
So that's interesting, because I know you've been through the cultural mastery course, and you just described stages one and two, you know, where you went through, even when you were still in Puerto Rico before you came to the United States, you know, you were already educating yourself and you were already engaging with people, which are stages one and two, mm-hmm. which I think is fascinating that, it, you know, we always try to teach our students, like before you go out there and actually play in the game, practice first, you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people burn up relationships, you know, and it sounds like you just really did something intuitively that really was helpful.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. It sort of helped me acclimatize a little bit faster to the experience of living in the States. It was very valuable. I still, you know, cherish it to this day.
And even then, it took you 2 years to feel like you, right?
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt. It's different, you know, to have, you know, easygoing conversations with folks that are not judging you for your language and your accent and the mispronunciations. When you're then in a work setting and you really have to be the best representative of yourself, you know, and try to speak very properly and cohesively and make sure that they're, you know, they're following through your conversation, your line of thought.
So you have how many children?
I have two kids.
And your kids, mm-hmm. your husband, I understand, is Italian, right? Italian background. Is mm-hmm. he like...
Italian background,
yes. Is he like immigrant Italian? Like, did he move from Italy to the United States, or did his parents move? What generation is he Italian?
He is, I want to say he's third generation. We were doing some research back when we visited Ellis Island in New York and were able to find his, you know, his great grandfather's name on the book, because he arrived from, you know, a little town in Italy called Campo Felice. And so it was, you know, a very proud, emotional moment to track the history of that family to where they ended up residing in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So he's a third generation, and just fascinating, you know, culture, very loving. Mm-hmm.
So does he speak Italian or no?
He speaks some. I was hoping he could teach me more, but he's actually become more of a lover of Spanish and has began to learn more and more. Yeah.
Interesting. That's the power of Boricua. That's the Puerto Rican power.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I think I influenced them enough. Probably, you know, the curiosity of learning from somebody who's totally different from what you grew up in. From listening to him, he says, you know what, there's not many Spanish-speaking people in my little hometown of Sharon, PA. There was like maybe one little Mexican restaurant, if that. And so when I, you know, met you, I had to break through some of my own stereotypes of what kinds of food and are they spicy? What do Puerto Ricans eat? Oh, and those kinds of things that So it was interesting for him to actually, you know, sort of begin to learn about a different culture through me. And I enjoyed, you know, being able to share who I was and who my culture, you know, is with him.
So which do you enjoy more, learning a new culture or teaching yours?
That's an interesting question. I find myself enjoying so much learning about others. And I think me sharing about myself happens more organically as people get to know me and they're more curious about me. So I don't find myself feeling as I'm teaching it, but more as I'm sharing some of myself. But I'm more purposeful in my mind of learning about others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you know, mm-hmm. I'm writing this book. It's called, and I haven't publicly said this, so I'll just go ahead and say this because we're going to publish this early next year. It's called Puerto mm-hmm. Rican Hillbillies. And the subtitle is The Adventures.
I love that title.
Thank you. Well, you know my background. So my dad's Puerto Rican and my mother was an orphan from the state of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So literally I'm a Puerto Rican hillbilly, right? And so this book has been inside of me like for years, right? And I never thought that I was just
finally coming out.
Well, I never, you know, it was like therapy, right? Just to mm-hmm. go back and to go through all of the different experiences and adventures of what it was like to grow up bicultural. Mm-hmm. The great things about it, but also a lot of challenges about it, right? As a child mm-hmm. and even older. And the subtitle right now is The Adventures of a Bicultural Half-Breed Human. And so anyway, I'm curious as to your children. I'm curious as to your children. What are some of the challenges you have with your own children in getting them to love and appreciate, let's say, the Puerto Rican culture, or even the Italian mm-hmm. culture, and because they're being raised in the American culture and the Atlanta, Georgia area. So what's that like for you?
Right. Couldn't that be any more of a bigger mix, you know, with just not only in their home, you know, their household having, you know, a Puerto Rican mom and an Italian American father, but then you go out into the community and you're influenced by all the different languages, all the different people are from different countries, and then your own sort of native, you know, the country accents here and the behaviors and all that they're exposed to. So it's a journey, you know, that you have by helping them sort of understand what their identity will be and just guiding them through their questions. My oldest, which is a girl, Ariana's 15, and she sees herself more as a Latina. She identifies more as a Latina, enjoys the music, the food, the culture, wants to cook it, wants to taste it, and shares that very openly with her friends at school. And now has began to learn Spanish more and more. So she's practicing it more with me at home and practicing at school. So she's really embracing more of the, you know, the Latino side of our heritage, and still loves some of the traditions that my husband brings to the table. You know, like during Christmas season, on Christmas Eve, we have the seven fishes, and then the next day we have the lechon asado. Yeah. So we have, you know, this dual embracing of the two cultures. And my little one as well, he's still kind of trying to figure out who he is. He's only 10 years old, but you know, it's a process. It's not something that you today wake up and say, I identify as this, and this is it, because you still have all these different currents that are underlying on your day-to-day life that influence you on your behavior and thoughts.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because it really is about identity and identification. Mm-hmm. And I know, mm-hmm. like for me, I had this huge, just deep rejection mm-hmm. of my mom's Southern culture. And I just didn't like
kidding.
It. No, I didn't like it at all. I always felt like, no, I'm Puerto Rican. And I always did. And the crazy thing, Rosan, was then I would go to Puerto Rico, but I wasn't really Puerto Rican, you know?
Exactly. The dichotomy, right?
There is a
dichotomy. You're caught up in the middle of the two. Yeah, there's a dichotomy to it. And I end up sometimes even having conversations with my oldest about what it is to be an American, because with all the social political things that she's exposed to day to day, she sometimes feels pride being an American, and sometimes she feels embarrassment.
Yes.
And I have to, you know, have very simple conversations, but deep at the same time, about not removing yourself from a part of you, because you can't just say this is all who you are. You still have a part of you that is, you know, it's through your blood, it's through your heritage. And so I want her to be able to embrace both and accept both. And sometimes there's the good and the not so good about either one of them, but just really learning to be who you are and accept who you are regardless.
You know, that's really not only meaningful, it's very deep. And I think those of us mm-hmm. who have gone through this experience understand exactly what you're saying and what your daughter's mm-hmm. going through. I went through it. And mm-hmm. I had a healing moment in my life because I had this deep rejection for the Southern culture. And what I never really realized right. was that by rejecting half of me, I was rejecting half of me.
Right.
And until yeah. until I embraced both of my heritages, I would never be mm-hmm. whole. I would never be emotionally healthy. And what exactly. happened was, and do you know Dr. Wayne Dyer? You know, he's deceased now, but he wrote some amazing mm-hmm. books and was a mainstay on PBS mm-hmm. for years. He wrote a book called Inspiration. And I'll never forget this. My oldest daughter, Andrea, uh-huh. had just graduated from high school. And as her graduation gift, I had some speaking engagements on the West Coast out in Los Angeles and also Washington States. And so I took her with me. And we're on the flight going out to Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. I'm reading this book by Dr. Dyer called Inspiration. And as I'm reading the book,
I don't think I've had the pleasure yet.
Oh, please read it. It's outstanding.
Oh, good. I'm
reading this book and I start to cry. And my daughter looks at me and says, Daddy, why are you crying? And I said, for the first time in my life, get why God put me in this unbelievably complex and mostly dysfunctional bicultural home, right?
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And what happened was Dr. Dyer took his own truth and the truth of his own upbringing and put it into this kind of metaphoric conversation mm-hmm. with God before he came to Earth. And he says, before I came to Earth, God asked me what I wanted to accomplish. And he said, I looked at God and I said, I want to teach people to forgive and I want to teach them to redeem. And God looked at me and said, are you sure? Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm absolutely sure. That's what I want to do. And so God says to me, and Dr. Dyer is speaking, but this was his experience. Well, then I'm going to put you in a family where your father is alcoholic and he's abusive and he's also going to abandon you.
Oh, wow.
And when you learn to forgive him, then you can teach forgiveness. And by the way, this is going to be so difficult on your mom that she won't be able to support you and your brother. And you're going to go through foster homes, your entire upbringing. And then eventually your mom's going to pull her life together. And when she comes back and redeems you and you understand the true joy of redemption, you can teach redemption. And I'm sitting, I'm crying on the airplane. And my daughter says to me, why are you crying, Daddy? And I said, it's the first time I ever made the connection as to why I was born into this family. Because it was we had so much pain in our family, right? And there was so much cultural conflict in our family. And it just connected. And I go, this is why I have this deep desire to help people from different cultures learn to love each other, right? Because for me, like that's like redemptive for me, you know? And so it's just like getting connection. Why? What does this mean for me? And your children will continue to kind of figure that out.
Right.
Once this book is published, the Puerto Rican Hillbillies book is published, I want to gift one for your older daughter because I think it will really resonate.
Oh, I will cherish that. I think she'll really enjoy it. I mean, I think it's that journey of finding your purpose that really, you know, helps you align your goals. Once you identify what is it that you feel you're here for, then you can determine what's your mission, right, in your life.
Absolutely.
And just begin to put steps towards that. It could be in your social aspect of your life, could be through your career, but I think you have to find your purpose. You have to identify what is it that drives you in the end, that makes you happy, that you could put passion and effort towards, and just begin to direct your steps in that direction.
that typically comes out of our experience. It's like, who am I, you know? And if it was painful, you know, how do I turn that pain into purpose? But if it was even pleasant or positive, how do I turn that and create that for other people, right? So you studied psychology and organizational psychology, right? How did you get into diversity and inclusion? Right. How did that become part of your mission and part of you?
I think it began when I arrived here to the United States, and I started to see, you know, folks sort of navigate towards me and begin to try to answer their questions through, you know, Rosanne, what is your experience? What are your thoughts on? Can you tell me about, you know? And so they would come to me for some sort of expertise, some sort of a thoughtful knowledge. And I began to see myself, you know, as that guidance, as providing some support to those questions that they had. And the more I looked into this field of diversity, I understood there is a path. There's a profession in this path that not only helps me fulfill, you know, that need, that purpose I have to support one another, regardless of our differences and because of our differences, and make a wonderful career out of it. So it's very meaningful to be able to do work that you feel is not really work. It's just your passion. How do you make a living out of something that you really you know, love? No. And it also comes from, as you said, the influences, your experiences. You know, I'm the daughter of a missionary, a poor family man that grew up in the middle of the island in a little town called Ajuntas. And my dad grew up with, you know, one pair of shoes, walking through creeks and rivers to get to a one-room school with his little siblings accompanying him through these little creeks. And so once he understood what his purpose was, which was taking care of others, he began to begin, you know, his journey as a physician. And I saw him, you know, caring for others in Guatemala and Haiti and Dominican Republic, and just carrying his medicine and instruments on donkeys across rivers and jeeps just to get to people that were 300 miles away from the nearest hospital. And I learned from him. I learned from his passion, his love for one another. And that was sort of instilled in me that you have to find something in your life that really fulfills you that same way that he did.
Oh my, that's just, we actually have something in common, because my father was the same. I mean, like, so I went to one of those one room schools in a barrio just outside of Ay Bonito called Pulguillas. And if you don't know
Spanish,
Pulguillas means little flea, right?
Little flea.
So that gives you an idea as to, this place was out in the boondocks, you know, to use one of the southern terms. And I went to one of those schools in fifth grade. And
Wow. That's incredible.
So did you travel with your dad to these other countries?
Mm-hmm. I was able to go to Dominican Republic and experience his work and see how he was able to engage others in his mission. He connected with the locals. He understood their needs. He connected also with, you know, whatever were the authority people in those little towns where perhaps others couldn't get to. He was able to connect with, you know, the colonels and the lieutenants in remote areas so that he could get passage, you know, as someone who was not a local, and be able to provide services that they didn't have the means for. And he was loved and respected.
That's amazing. You know, I live in the Dominican Republic, and
yes,
the Dominicans love the Puerto Ricans, and they respect us. It's interesting, right?
And I love them.
Maybe your dad is one of the reasons why. Who knows? We don't know, right?
Exactly. You never know what barriers he was able to, you know, break through that now has opened doors for many others. And there's a special place in my heart for the Dominican Republic because of him and the work he did there. Still have some loving friends there. I was going to share that he himself had a very interesting, not only upbringing, but a condition he was born with where he would break often. His bones would break for, you know, maybe even simple falls and things like that. And so I could see him trying to push through regardless of those, you know, physical barriers. And I learned from him quite a bit. I inherited the same condition. And I have osteogenesis imperfecta. And so it's a hidden disability where some days you see me well, walking fine, and another day I'm limping or I broke an ankle or a knee and I'm using a scooter and having to trust and build safety in my workplace for me to share who I am and to get the support I need when I need someone to come to my car and get the wheelchair out of the back of my car, you know, and just build those relationships that can really withstand the test of time and support of each other.
So an inclusive workplace isn't just about minorities and differences. It's about, like in your case, with the
very true
challenge that you have, right? It goes beyond
exactly
what a lot of us typically think, where it's about, maybe it's about race or it's about just about ethnicity, but what's an inclusive
race, gender, and all those things.
Mm-hmm. How would you define an inclusive workplace? What does that mean?
I define it with having intentionality. You know, diversity is bringing people together. How many tallies do you have, you know, this count of this many Latinos or African Americans or Asians and this many women and this many men? That's just the diversity. That's the mix. But the inclusion is the intentionality of bringing together those people because of their differences and leveraging their differences, learning from those differences, because with those come the different thoughts, the different perspectives, the perspective of thoughts, and you can benefit from each other. If you have the ability to put the right group of people together, and it's very beneficial for the organization and their objectives and their strategies.
Can I take that just a little bit deeper, Rosanne? And I want to, for example, in your case, so you have this physical challenge with your bone structure as your father had, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see things not just like what we would, and I say we, the normal person out there who doesn't have this perspective.
Right.
Do you see things, you know, the obvious is a wheelchair ramp and things like that, but do you see other things from a business perspective that are deeper that maybe the average person wouldn't even think of, but because of your condition, you kind of go, you know, if we did this, then that would create this for this market or for this group of people. Do you see things there that are deeper perhaps than most people as it relates? Because I think most people just see, let's give parking spaces to people who have physical challenges or let's put wheelchair ramps. I think it's kind of where it stops. But what else? Maybe you could give us some examples. I think we could almost take that principle and apply it to almost any different cultural perspective. But I'm just curious.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. In many areas. I mean, not only from like those types of physical tactical items that you could put together, but if you were to think, for example, in the healthcare space, you were to think of equity in healthcare, which groups perhaps are having less access to care, perhaps there's having less adherence to treatment and medication. What are the results of their care long term? Are there differences there? And so that allows me to see, with all this collecting data, I can begin to see where there's need for our physicians to put more effort, for our healthcare totality of our environment to be very inclusive, to think through the needs of some of this, you know, of these communities, you know, from African Americans needing perhaps a deeper follow-up on hypertension, for Latinos and diabetes, for you know, colorectal screenings in various communities, for even the LGBT community. So is the workplace ready and prepared to address those needs and help have an environment that's adjustable that can really support those different employees in their workplace? For our own disabled staff and members, patients that come into our medical offices, well, perhaps they need, you know, interpreter services, perhaps they need Braille, perhaps they need hearing devices. So we have to think through the websites that we build, the colors that we use in our computers for people that they can read and see well, what colors are you using? What fonts are you using? I mean, it could be a myriad of aspects that an organization can look through to begin to address some of the needs of their market. You have to understand what your market is and really put forth some initiatives that are driven to impact the communities that you serve.
So is inclusion about access?
It could be. Very much it could be about access. Inclusion can be about building the right environment. Inclusion could be about allowing for people to grow within organizations and allowing them to be their authentic selves at work and not have to feel like they're judged and rejected for who they are.
So some companies say diversity and inclusion, and other companies say inclusion and diversity. Is there a difference or is it just semantics?
I think there's a clear difference in what each of the terms mean. How you play with, you know, being one first or another depends on the efforts of the strategy, perhaps it's the vision of that particular organization to put inclusion first, meaning it to me is more important to leverage who we are, the people that we have, than the headcount and the tally. And I may see that happening in the future where we will begin to understand more the topics of equity and inclusion and less focus on diversity, because the diversity is already there. We're trying to work with making sure that the people that are in there with their diversity feel like they're valued.
Isn't it possible to bring in a very diverse workforce, but to have an unprepared leadership group?
Very, yes.
And who is
it
not?
It is very possible to... You could have a very diverse group of people, but if they're only allowed to think one way and perform a certain way, that does not allow them to use their own perspectives and opinions, then you're not benefiting from diversity at all. And the risk that the organizations may take is that they will leave. You bring them in, but they don't see anybody else like themselves. They don't see anyone that is similar to them and their ideals throughout leadership in the organization, that eventually they won't feel connected to your mission. And so they will leave the organization. That's a big risk that organizations should not be willing to take.
It seems to me, and this is my own personal opinion, and you may know my opinion because I know you've been through some of my training. It seems to me that in so many places, the cart is before the horse, right? And we talk about bringing in all these groups of diverse people, but it seems to me we should prepare our leadership to be culturally healthy and skilled before we bring those people in. Because if we don't, it's as you just said, we're going to repel people. And even if we don't repel them because they quote unquote need a job, we're not going to get the most out of them because we won't know how, you know?
Exactly.
And we won't.
I can understand that. And I think I don't know if there's a cart before the horse. I think the diversity is already here. Mm-hmm. What we need to perhaps begin to put effort is in building an inclusive leadership perspective, building the trust in our employees to feel like they can speak up and say what they need to say and be respected and not retaliated against. Inclusive leadership is not just for those that have a diverse workforce in the sense of gender, race, or ethnicity. I think it's for any leader. It doesn't depend on those traditional classifications, but having an inclusive leadership perspective is being self-aware, is being fair, is being courageous, is being curious. And so some of those attributes, I say, all of them are of great benefit to any leader, and that will make you inclusive. If you're self-aware, then you're able to tell, hey, I said something that may have not been appropriate. Let me ask more about this. Let me go and say, hey, I'm sorry I said this and offended you. Please tell me more about it. How can I be of support to you? And that builds that courageous sense of self where you can, you know, not only identify where you may have made a mistake or you did something great, but you can go and say, tell me more about it. Help me learn about it.
But that's a bit of a catch-22 in the corporate world, because if a corporate leader, let's say, who is not culturally skilled or healthy or non-developed, let's say, which I would contend is most leaders at this point, and that's just based on our data and our study, if they make or if they misstep culturally or they say something to someone that was inappropriate or offensive to another person, aren't their jobs actually on the line at this point?
Yeah. And more now than ever, I think there's a risk to how far you go with, you know, your comments and opinions, because the social media is so out there that organizations can't take the risk of saying something that's you know, and totally inappropriate and offensive, and think that they can be safe in the end. They will be bashed out there. It will be spread very quickly. So it is important that you have that self-awareness, that you do understand that there are some, you know, repercussions to what you do and say.
Do you think the call-out culture is healthy for the overall cultural health of our country?
I think we're in a long journey. At one point in my career, I was thinking, okay, a diversity and inclusion leader, one day I'll run out of work to do, and people will be totally understanding of each other, respectful, will value one another, and I won't have a job to do. But that doesn't seem to be the case. I think there's still great opportunities for us to learn from each other still.
The other day I was speaking with a lady who is the director of diversity and inclusion for a large company. And she is Latina. I won't name which country. I don't want to in any way give away her identity.
Right.
And she was giving a presentation, a public presentation, to company employees. And within the presentation, she used a picture that offended someone. She was oblivious to it. She didn't have any idea that this particular picture would be offensive, but it was.
Right.
And rather, and this is really where I'm going with this, because I think true inclusiveness would allow for an open conversation right then and there that would be loving and kind and respectful. Right. Rather than the person who was offended simply feeling the ability or opportunity to have a deeper conversation during the presentation, the person went to the presenter's superior, who then went to her superior, and all of a sudden now it's a mess.
Right.
How do we avoid that kind of stuff? Yeah. Because it's not possible to talk about culture. It's not possible to not offend someone at some point for some reason. How do we create an inclusive environment where if we do make a mistake, or if we were just oblivious to something, that we can actually have a conversation without somebody getting fired over it or going through discipline over it? How does this happen?
Right. I think there's an important aspect of intentionality. And as you build a strategy around diversity and inclusion in your organization, I think you have to also build the expectation that we are working with and for each other. And that if you feel that at one point or another, you know, you've been offended or something did not sit well with you, that you have the opportunity to speak up. And that's a big term this day. So you have the opportunity and the right to speak up directly to that person and just go and say, with respect and kindness, This is how I received that message. And if you build that as sort of the overarching value that, you know, you're giving each other the benefit of the doubt, and that there's, you know, there's more to a simple word, there's intentionality behind it, that perhaps you want to go directly to that person and share how you feel about it. And that comes from building trust. It comes from having the psychological safety that you feel that if I go to you and say, you know, this didn't sit well with me, can you tell me more about what you meant by it? It will open the doors for deeper conversation rather than punishment.
My guest today has been the amazing Rosamaris Rivera Petrillo. Thank you so much, Rosan, for being on Culture Matters. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Muchísimo. Thank you so much.